as I got older, and once I became a P and started being in charge of people, especially after Jay got murdered, I would make it a point when I was traveling. If I pull up and I see somebody on a motorcycle that was a civilian, I'd go over and introduce myself and talk to them and just try to let them understand that they have nothing to fear for me.
How did that go over? Were you received well, or people still intimidated?
Sometimes I was, but you could never, really tell if you were being received because someone wanted to hear what you had to say, or because they were afraid that they'd get picked up. They didn't listen. Mm-hmm. It's an interesting lifestyle, and being a president of a charter, it's a very powerful position.
Hey gang, welcome back to part two of this week's episode of Game of Crimes with Murph in the Morning. Our guest this week is Malachi Seaman, former police officer, tribal police officer, former Vagos member, outlaw motorcycle gang member. And we got into a good story yesterday where he's still prospecting and ended up in a shooting. Was that in Reno where that shooting took place?
Yes, sir.
And you've made it out of town now. Everybody's getting back to where they're supposed to be. But one thing I want to ask you from yesterday, you said that when you left Quickie to go on this run, that they had not prepared you about the dangers associated with this. But at the same time, you're carrying a pistol everywhere you go. Why were you carrying a gun if you didn't know about the dangers?
Well, I always carried a gun. But I mean, I wasn't naive mm-hmm. in the fact that I didn't understand the totality of everything. I just meant I wasn't really up. Quickie kept a real close gag order on Missouri, mm-hmm. for lack of a better word. So I had no idea what was going on with any other sharks. I call them sharks or teams mm-hmm. with the other guys. It was one of the best things probably could have happened to me, because I learned to depend on numero uno. Mm-hmm. Okay. Because as a prospect, looking back, I should not have been traveling those distances by myself. And then when the banditos got word that I was prospecting, I was living in New Mexico and prospecting in Missouri, I was given a phone number, and I had to call them and say, hey, I'm going out of town which made absolutely no sense. I had to call the banditos and let them know I was on my way to Missouri, and I couldn't wear my colors. I had to put my cut in my saddlebags until I got to the state line. So I had to leave New Mexico before I could put them on. Texas has got banditos in it. So it was always this lack of communication bullshit thing that was always going on. And we'll get into that a little bit about, I always thought when one of these gangs had a bunch of charters in the city, mm-hmm. it was because they were big and powerful. It's because they don't get along. So they separate. So you might talk to, a guy named Trash and get permission to ride through Albuquerque. But if you don't have this other guy's permission and they have no communication, that is one of the biggest things that I ran into all the time, is just no communication. So you get permission from one guy and you don't have permission from this guy. And it's just a shit show.
Jeez. Well, in Reno, who was the shootout between?
So the shootout was between the Hells Angels and the Vagos. What happened was San Jose chapter president, Jeff Pettigrew, got a group of Hells Angels together. And I never confirmed this. This is a story I heard, is that he had a petition. He was trying to get everybody to sign, because he wanted all of his dream was for all the teams to come together and face their common enemy of law enforcement. And what I was told was that he came in the casino with the intention of getting signatures, and he made a mistake that I would make later in my career, which is he would let his status as a officer in an outlaw motorcycle gang lure him into a false sense of security, mm-hmm. that he would be respected and he would be left alone. And unfortunately, at some point in the casino, he ran into a guy named Jabbers, and Jabbers was, for the lack of a better term, he was a member that couldn't control his alcohol, and he was a bully. And when he got drunk, he ran his mouth, and that all could have been prevented if one of his brothers would have took charge of him and put his ass to bed. But and unfortunately,
he was HA also.
He was a Vago, and he started shit with Jeff Pettigrew. And, when I was a president and leading, I would tell members all the time when they would do something that I disliked, I'm like, look, dude, don't be weak. There's no room for weak people in this lifestyle. You weak people put guys like me in prison or in a pine box. Get your shit together and move forward. But there's a lot of that that went on. You know, that situation should have never happened. You know what mm-hmm. I mean? And then look what Jabbers did. You know, I don't know if you're familiar with the situation, but he got arrested. And I know what that feels like. You get arrested, and then all of these guys that are supposed to be your brother, that are supposed to have your back, no matter what, they don't show up for you. And when that happens, it puts you in a really lonely position. And that guy, mm-hmm. because he's a coward and he's weak, he decided that he would make friends with the other side and everything was going to be okay. Did I ever hear anything as a member, even later on, that Romeo was put up to, that it was calculated, that they construed to kill him? No, I didn't. But I understand why Jabbers did that, because he thought he was going to get out. He thought if he cooperated, he was going to get off scot-free. And they used him to get that case built and then put him in jail anyway.
Mm-hmm.
And then now he's a rat. He's out bad, which, I mean, that doesn't mean anything. Well, we can touch on that.
Yeah, you know? I want to ask you about that. In fact, I want to ask you right now, why does anybody want to get involved with an outlaw motorcycle gang? What's the attraction there? I mean, I know the bikes to start with, but you know, it's an outlaw style, lifestyle.
You know, my dad, when he got out of the Vietnam vets, I remember I got a little older and it started to get a little more savvy about me. I asked him, I was like, you know, Dad, why did that not work out? And he's like, politics, son. He's like, if you could just ride with your brothers and do the things that you want to do, the world would be a better place. But politics. I was just like, oh yeah, okay, that makes sense. And it didn't make any sense. But years later, I would run into that word, and I understand now wholeheartedly what he meant. And what's the draw? I was used to being in a uniform and getting a certain result when I presented myself to the public mm-hmm. in law enforcement. And when I became a VAGO, there was a very similar, maybe even more of an intimidation than respect thing. And it is addicting. It's something you just get used to so fast that when I pull up on my motorcycle, if I'm by myself and I got my two top buttons buttoned, which means I'm ready to handle business, people fear you. You know what I mean? Mm-hmm. And I used to, at first, I think I enjoyed that. But then as I got older, once I became a P and started being in charge of people, especially after Jay got murdered, I would make it a point when I was traveling. If I pull up and I see somebody on a motorcycle that was a civilian, I'd go over and introduce myself and talk to them and just try to let them understand that they have nothing to fear for me.
How did that go over? Were you received well, or people,
you know,
still
sometimes I was, but you could never, you know, really tell if you were being received because someone wanted to hear what you had to say or because they were afraid that they'd get the shit kicked out of them if they didn't listen.
Mm-hmm.
But yeah, it's an interesting lifestyle, and being a president of a charter, you know, it's a very powerful position. You know, there's just, like I said, we can get more into that as we go on, but it's, you know, it's a very powerful position that once you get used to, man, it's, yeah.
An addiction, you said it. I think it's, not to speak for you, but it sounds like you want to be a member of a group, and it's a group that you trust, just like your dad was with his buddies, the former Vietnam Veterans Motorcycle Club. It's still, did you not realize when you joined the VAGOs that it's an outlaw motorcycle gang, that they're involved in crime, that they're involved in intimidation and thieves and thievery and narcotics and weapons and all that stuff?
I understood. Like, I didn't understand the totality of everything. And those things would come to me. Those things would become second nature to me. Mm-hmm. But the things that they don't tell you about that are going to cause you more danger than anything is not the laws you're breaking, not the people that you're hurting, but your own brothers, the things that they're mm-hmm. going to do to you.
Wow.
The knives that they're going to stick in your back.
Yeah, that's sad to say. And unfortunately, in law enforcement, we don't have a lot of those people, but they are there.
Yeah.
It's all about them. So what year did you actually patch in, become a patched member of the VAGOs?
So 7 months after Reno, I would become a full patch member and get voted in unanimously into the Springfield Charter.
And who was your sponsor?
I had two people. I had the president that stepped down. I can't remember his name. He got in trouble. Grumpy. But Souls was more of the guy that mentored me. Mm-hmm. He was a full patch member. He was working in Missouri, but he was actually out of Nevada. One of the dudes I miss, man, to be honest with you, another guy that got screwed over, went to prison, and he was a great man. He was a Marine Scout sniper, and they called him Souls. I was one of these naive guys, like, coming up wet behind mm-hmm. the ears. And so I would, hey, how'd you get your nickname? And Souls is like, well, when I was in Iraq, he's like, I made up these forms. And he's like, I would take like candy bars and stuff and trade them to the kids or men or women. And they would sign that affidavit, signing their soul over to me. And he was just an interesting guy. Only one night did he ever get enough liquor in him where he started telling stories. But I'll tell you what, that guy went through a lot.
Jeez. Was that demonic worship he's doing by claiming their souls, or
I think it was just a way for him to deal with the horrors of war, man. You know, mm-hmm. I mean, I was never in combat. I was never, I was never in combat as a,
in the military
as a, an operator, but, right. The things that I've seen in my lifetime have affected me, and I've had to do, I've had to do things to help to deal with that,
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
But I've met some of the most amazing people in this journey, people that you could never tell me. If you'd have told me 15 years ago that I'd be doing what I'm doing and that Jeff Viles would be somebody that I owe my life to, I would have told you, I would have laughed in your face. So,
wow. So that was the shooting in Reno. Was that 2011?
Correct.
Okay. And you're living in New Mexico, but you're patching in Missouri. How far is that apart?
14 hours from my shop to the doorstep of so, Quickie's house.
We've had some retired police officers on the show here that infiltrated some of the different outlaw motorcycle gangs.
Mm-hmm.
And when they were prospecting, they were expected to be on call 24/7.
Correct.
So how was it, if you're 14 hours away and you got a job and you got a family, how were you available to the club in Missouri to do things that they wanted you to do?
So I was only available in the times that I would go spend there. I would go spend 2 weekends a month doing that. So it wasn't overwhelming, but we had a lot of runs and stuff like that. And then we had an incident with the Galloping Goose out there. And then that regime leadership changed out there because the president at the time had Quickie's daughter on the back of the bike, and there was an ambush at an off ramp, couple gunshots, fisticuffs, and this dude took off on his bike. That yo Tomas guy I told you about left the girl there, and it was just a shit show, man.
Mm.
And so the next significant thing that happened after that was I went to go see Dragon Man.
And he's located where?
He's in Santa Monica.
Okay.
Because with all the stuff that's happened in the time that I prospected and patched in, all the stuff that I'm seeing going on, I got all of these guys in the charter with one guy gave a guy a 45, So basically what's happened is Quickie is playing God in Missouri. One guy, it was in our charter, named Milkman. He owned a dairy farm. Had to milk his cows twice a day. So he never, the entire time he was a Vago, ever left Missouri to go on any runs
mm-hmm.
because he couldn't. And I'm like, what? That doesn't even make any sense. And so what I wanted to do is find out, this is what I felt like. When I patched in, I noticed a significant difference from my center patch with low key on it and the ones that I saw in California. So I decided that I was going to throw caution to the wind and I was going to go talk to number three. And I was going to explain to him everything that was going on with Missouri. So I went and I met this dude and I walked in his house and he started cutting shit off of my cut. Walked up to me face to face, started cut. This is fake. This is fake. Cutting it off. And so then I started telling him what was going on. And he said, you know what, dude, we're going to an officer's meeting. And it was a pretty scary thing. I had to wait at a location and then a guy came and got me and he covered my face, put a cloth sack over my head, and drove me to another place. And when I got out, I stood there and waited. These dudes used like two different kinds of wands to check. Basically, they didn't strip me naked, but checked me completely. Walked me in, and it was pretty scary. I walk in, and there's all of these. These aren't just members. These are presidents, vice presidents, sergeant-at-arms. And Dragon Man stood up there and he said, I want you to tell all of these guys what you just told me. So I told him. This national president, Tata, was standing there and he's like, well, who exactly did Quickie John tell you he was? And I said, well, he told me he was you. And there's a couple of comments. Like one of the guys said, well, are you just pissed off because you feel like you bought bunk dope? And I said, no, I got asked to prospect into this organization. I've done my due diligence. You know, I've handled business when I've had to handle it. I've done everything that was asked of me. And then on the day that I get voted in 100% by everybody in my charter and they give me my patches and make me sew them on and pour beer on me and give me a hug and tell me that I'll be taken care of for the rest of my life. They'll always have my back. Nobody will ever let me down. This dude is giving me, none of this stuff is real. And so Tata to ask everybody in the room, he said, we're going to get rid of a lot of these guys and Quickie John's going to answer for his actions. What do you want to do with this dude? And he's all, I want to 100% vote. If we get all hands, he can stay. If we don't, he can go. And everybody raised their hand. And so I had to go trade my old stuff for new stuff. So then I got legit stuff. All my patches were legit from National, like they're supposed to come. And Quickie got pulled into a meeting and they center punched him, took his patch, made him a prospect for, I think somebody said it was a year. I didn't see him very much. So then I go back to New Mexico and we have a great business. I've already brought my dad in. I brought him in through Springfield.
Mm-hmm. He's a patched member.
So now my dad's a patch holder. Yes. And then I get a call. I'm at work one day. Business is going good. I get a call from Dragon Man and he said, I need you to stop what you're doing. And I need you to come to North Hollywood to the clubhouse. I'm like, okay. And so I think I'm probably almost a year in now, maybe 6 months as a patch holder after this last incident. So I pull up to the clubhouse and, there's nobody there. I'm like, that's odd. There's a couple of cars, a couple of bikes, but normally it's fucking, you know, there's a North Hollywood, Lancashire Boulevard, big ass two-story clubhouse, you know? And, I go in, it's kind of hard to see. And I get kind of snatched up as soon as I walk in. And, I kind of thought somebody was trying to hug me, but then I realized that I was being restrained, that I had tube on each side of me. And they stripped my cut off me, stripped me basically down to my underwear and set me in a wooden chair. And then all of the national cabinet is sitting there looking at me. And the national president comes up to me and he hands me my application that I filled out to be a VAGO. And he's all, you a cop? And I said, so when I was filling the application out, my Uncle Quickie said, make sure that you are honest. So on that application, it says Fort Mojave Tribal Police Department. And so my mind's working 1,000 miles a minute trying to figure out my next best move. And I said, dude, look, I was out of a job. My wife was on my back. I took this job. I wasn't a cop. I said, all I did was work in the motorcade. I washed cars. And I was told that I had to be honest. So I put it down. And so in the back of my mind, I'm thinking, look, I never made a fucking nickel. There's no paycheck stubs. Mm-hmm. I never was post-certified. And that's what they're going to look for. They're going to try to find a post-certification online. And so I just lied. And I went to a hotel for a couple of days. Dude, Al took my fingerprints, made me sign a document, asked me a couple of questions about my background, and they said they'd get back with me. And then a couple of days later, I get called back, and I walk in, and Tata puts my cut back on me, and he tells me, nobody will ever ask you about this again. And I'm sorry, I owe you one. And
now, who is Tata?
Tata's the national president at the time. And so what's interesting is the catalyst for this lie that I've told that's earned me this favor is I'm going to cash that favor in to open a charter in a bandito ran state. And that's ultimately going to get my brother murdered. But I was never questioned again about it. Nobody ever said anything. And I just went back to work, started doing the things that I was supposed to be doing. And then it just doesn't make any sense geographically anything for me to be traveling 14 hours to go be a part of Springfield. And I was already done with Quickie. Tuck, who had became our new president, was just a young guy that was more into partying and anything. And it just wasn't a comfortable fit for me. Now I'm vested, both feet are in. And so I'm like, I want to get serious with this. So I had been working since I got back from the clubhouse. I'd been working on this notion that, cause I had a great group of guys. I had, mm-hmm. I wanted to bring my brother Jay in. I had another set of brothers, Shannon and can't remember the other guy's name. I had a guy named David Cordova. So I think we had a dozen guys. A guy from Beach Cities had moved out to be with his mom in California. And so I had him. So we had enough guys to make a charter. So then I went and got in front of National again. And I said, look, this is what I want to do. And I remember Tata, he was just like, do you understand what it is that you're asking for? And I told him, yeah, I understand. And I had, like, hindsight, I had no idea what I was asking for. And he didn't want to do it. You know, they talked about doing like a four corners bottom rocker and, you know, trying to, you know, not step on the bandito's toes. But no, I just told him, if we open a charter in New Mexico, it doesn't matter if the bottom rocker says Disneyland, it's going to be on, you know? And so I told him, you owe me one. So you have to give this to me.
You called him out in front of everybody?
Well, it's just him and I, but he understood. And he said, okay. So a few months later, I wanted to prospect a few of the guys and patch in the rest of the guys. But National made the decision. They invited us to Las Vegas. We went to the Buffalo Chips Casino. And I walked in with all my guys. They looked at everybody. I turned in everybody's paperwork. And Bigfoot handed me a bunch of New Mexico bottom rockers. And they gave us their blessing. Quickie John got in trouble at that one. That was the one where, you know, they took his shit. So he was mad at me. Mm-hmm. And then it was crazy because he was trying to introduce me to this guy that was wanted to be a prospect. And I recognized the dude. I was like, where do I know that dude from? And then I would go back and see him on Gangland. And he was a former Mongol that had turned state's evidence. And so this dude was just, like I said, a used car salesman, I'll probably say that a few more times, but we get blessed with this charter and we're sent back. We have a big party. So now I've got a complete charter. My brother's my sergeant at arms. I make this guy Bull my VP, and I've never been a P4 before. I've been a patch holder less than a year. Now I'm president of this charter. Bantito ran territory. And so I just pretty much sat down with my dad, the whole charter, and I'm like, this is what's going on. Nobody goes anywhere by themselves. This is what I want done. We're all working in the shop. I had a guy named Sammy that had been a nomad that we brought into the charter. And so we just get back to New Mexico and start, you know, business as usual. And we're flying every day and making sure that we're out there seeing. My first face-to-face with the banditos was a gunfight, and it never got any better from there. There was never any casual encounters. There was never any, hey, let's sit down and, you know, whatever. It was just, I got a gun stuck in my face. So my first few years in the Bagos, prior to Jay being killed, I was sober. Everybody in my charter was sober. We all wore our 13 upside down. 13 lets people know that you party. That stands for the 13th letter of the alphabet, which is an M. So if I have a 13 on, people know that I smoke meth or I smoke marijuana. So we wore those upside down, which pissed a lot of people off, but that was my rule. No drinking, no partying. Like, we all stick together and we're going to make this work. We're going to build this and make it work.
Mm-hmm.
And so we've had this charter open for about 4 months now, and I go to chair a meeting at this AA club, and it's one way to get in there, one way out. And me and my dad ride wearing our colors, and my mother follows us in the car with my wife, my daughter Janessa, and my brother Japheth. And when we got there, we got inside and I started situating the meeting, and I saw a guy with the Bandito support shirt get up and walk outside. And so I told Jay, who was my sergeant at arms, I said, hey, go tune that dude up and get rid of him. I don't want him here. And so my brother went out there and took his phone, thumped him, sent him on his way. And then he came back in and he's like, we need to leave. He's like, he was on his phone when I got out there before I got his phone from him. I said, okay. And so we left. We went and got on our bikes and we started pulling out. And this white truck is coming down the road. And I thought, is this kid Bobby that I knew? So I stopped, got off my bike and walked. They kind of turned in front of me. I walked up to the truck and realized there was two full patch banditos in this pickup truck. And the guy, before I can say anything, the dude just pulls out a Glock and just sticks it right in my eye socket. And I'm carrying a Glock 40 caliber and a drop down holster on my left side because I'm a southpaw. And I just remember thinking, well, it's short career, bro. And I know my family's behind me. So I'm like, I'm going to yank this pistol out and get a couple rounds off, see if I can buy them some time. And so I quick drawed and stuck my gun right in his face, and then realized that he wasn't a shooter. his eyes got about this big, and he just punched the fucking pedal to the metal on the truck and took off. Well, about that time, my brother Jay saw what was going on, and he stepped out right in front of this fucking And all I can think of is, you know, he's dead. They're going to hit him. So I started unloading into the cab of the truck. And then somehow Jay got out of the way enough to where the truck just caught the end of him and spun him around. He always carried a set of 45s under his arm, so he pulled him out and we just lit those guys up. And then I turn around and look, and my old man's sitting on his bike smoking a cigarette the whole time. And I'm like, what are you doing? And he's like, you look like you guys had it under control, man. So I said, let's get on the freeway and go to the shop. So we went to the shop.
And what is your wife and mom doing with all this is going on?
Just
crapping her pants?
Probably, man. So we raced back to the shop. Quickie John, the used car salesman, was there in a motorhome visiting with Sammy and Mikey were the other guys there. And I pulled up and I said, lock the shop down. I called all the members to the shop and put a couple of guys on the roof with AKs, barricaded the doors, put all the girls in a car with one guy and sent them out of town and waited for the banditos to come and kill us. And nothing happened. The next morning, gang task force shows up in force and knock on the door and ask me for me by name. So I went to the door and I said, what's up? And they said, look, Malachi, we have witnesses. We know what happened. We understand that you're a victim, but you need to tell us what's going on. You need to come down to the station and cooperate. You need to help us defuse the situation before it gets out of control, before somebody gets hurt. And I just told them, look, I'm in fear for my life and we are going to defend ourselves, but I don't have anything to say. And probably another month goes by. And then one of my guys, Shannon, breaks protocol and he leaves his house by himself. And bandits are watching him and they catch him at a gas station and they beat him really good. And they took his bike. They didn't get his cut. He took off and, you know, he was only a mile or so from the shop. So he showed up at the shop all beat up. And then his bike was out of gas while he pulled in the gas station. So we found the bike a couple of blocks from the gas station. That was the first time I had to discipline somebody. And so, you know, he got the rest of the shit baby out of him and took all of his stuff. I took his bike, took his cut, sent him down the road. And it was difficult because his brother was still in, you know, and I just told him, look, dude, this is not a game. You know, this isn't a play lifestyle. These guys mean business and we will do okay if everybody listens to what I'm trying to say. Follow the rules that I put down. And then we just continue to do what we were doing. We were having a really good year with the shop. We'd already sold a couple of custom bikes and the gang task force was really close. They were on the shop a lot. I remember one day a couple of banditos came up in plain clothes, like acting like they were going to buy some motorcycles and kind of got a little closer than they should have. But then the task force was watching them and they showed up, like they got out and separated us. And then my brother actually picked up a case right before he got murdered because we were on such a high alert there at the shop trying to run a business and watch out for that other team. And it didn't make any sense. Some type of an officer, I don't know what agency he worked for. He wasn't a beat cop though. He was like for something. Instead of calling down and talking to gang task force in Albuquerque and getting our information, our address, he decided to drive from Santa Fe in an unmarked Grand Prix with tinted windows. And so he came to the shop and I was inside the shop, but I saw him drive by and my brother was outside. But then when he came back, my brother pulled his firearm out. He was also left-handed, pulled out his firearm and kind of kept it by his side. And the guy called for backup and had my brother arrested for aggravated assault with a deadly weapon. So that's how I met Ray Tuig, who would come into play to help defend me against the charges that I got, is we hired Ray to help with my brother.
And so he's an attorney.
Yeah, he's a really good attorney. And then, then August 4th, 2013, Charter's 8 months old. My brother's been in the Vagos for 8 months. I got a call a couple of days before. This was a Sunday, but I think Friday and Saturday, I got a call from the dude Epi saying that he was doing this fundraiser and if we were going to come and visit. And then I didn't answer the phone on the particular Sunday, but it was another call asking if we were coming. I had guys in the charter that day doing different things, some doing family things and a couple guys doing some business for me. So the only people that were available were myself, my brother Japheth, and a guy, and a regular member named David Cordova. So I rode down. I was actually backing out of my driveway. And so just to give you the idea of how I left my house on a normal day or how I would be at the shop working is I would have three extra magazines of 40 caliber ammo, my 40 caliber pistol and a drop down holster, a level 3 bulletproof vest, and then my cut over it. And that's how we walked around that city. This Sunday morning, I was backing out of my driveway. The garage door was closing and someone stopped the door and it started opening. And my little girl, Janessa, she came out and she was holding up my bulletproof vest. And she was like, "Daddy, are you going to wear this?" So I stopped and got off my bike and took my cut off and put it on, put my cut back on, gave her a kiss, and rode down to the shop. And just a lot of things, man, that day. Like, you know, we all got together. I kissed my mom and dad. I said, where Epi's motorcycle shop was on 4th and Manal, and our shop was on 1st and Manal. So it was like three city blocks.
Mm-hmm.
And so we all got our cuts on and everything, and I grabbed like $250 out of the till because I didn't want to go there and not donate some money. And we rode our bikes down there and pulled up into the front of the shop. And the investigator that Ray Tuig hired, that was an ex-Army Ranger operator, would say that I drove my guys into a horseshoe-style ambush with one way in and one way out. I remember pulling up in that driveway and putting my kickstand down on my bike next to the garage roll-up door about 10 feet from me. And as I'm getting off my motorcycle, that garage door rolls up and a guy comes flying out of there with an 8-foot 2x4 that had been cut in half, so about 4 feet of 2x4.
Mm-hmm.
And comes right at me. I pulled my asp out. I had a collapsible baton that I carried and cracked him with it. And my brother hit him a couple times and pretty much that was it. And I look over to my left and there's a guy just like this pointing a gun at me.
Are they wearing colors?
He was wearing, these guys were. So it's interesting facts that day. So the only patches that were being worn there that day were the Black Berets, which is a Bandito support club. But I know for a fact that I identified two members of the Banditos that were not in Banditos colors that were in the crowd. And I believe it was seven individuals that were all shooting at us, the three of us, and when the shooting started. But when that gentleman pointed, he had to drop on me. He could have killed me right then. So I put my hands up, dropped a baton. He holstered his gun. I said, "Look, man, that dude came after me. We were here to donate and be a part of this fundraiser, but we're leaving now." So I told Jay, "Let's get out of here." I got on my bike and I started backing up. Japheth and David, who had parked a little in front of me, opted to just lift their bikes up and start walking them backwards. But we're in full retreat mode at that point. Mm-hmm. And then I just remember hearing a gunshot go off and my windshield on my bike exploded. Something hit me in the chest and I went over backwards off my bike. Somehow got my kickstand out because my bike was resting on its kickstand when I got back up. But I didn't have a helmet on. I had a baseball cap on backwards. So I hit my head pretty good on the way down. So I was open my eyes, trying to get my wits about me. My brother Jay comes over and he grabs me like by my cut and he slides me up behind this guy had an old steel horse trailer that he made into a place to sell sunglasses. And Jay looked at me and he said, "Hey, there ain't no fundraiser here. These guys are here to kill us. Don't move. Stay here." And I would never see Jay alive again after that. I'm emotional and catch myself.
It's okay.
So I got up and I just, the thing that I noticed first was that we were getting showered with bullets and it didn't seem like there was anything defensive happening. So I unholstered my Glock and I stuck my head out around this steel trailer door. And when I did, it just got riddled with bullets. So the next time I push my weapon out and I fire a couple of rounds downrange and then I look to try to see what's going on. And I see David Cordova with two pistols in front of him, cowering behind his bike with his hands over his ears, coward. And then I look over to the left, fire a couple more rounds, and I can see my brother's feet, and I can see one of his hands is convulsing. This is the beginning of that gunfight, and at this point, all I can think of is that somebody knocked Jay out. As impossible as that was for me to fathom, that's the extent of it. And so it's me and seven guys shooting back and forth, and all I want to do is get to my brother. And I'm yelling at him. I'm just like, "I just want to get to my brother. Stop shooting." And every time I try to advance, I'll fire a couple rounds. And every time I get out from behind cover, they just let me have it, man. I finally got to him once and I pushed a little harder than I should have. And I just kept unloading rounds as I'm moving forward, got a hold of him. And my brother is a big dude, man. I grabbed a hold of him and I couldn't move him. And then bullets are whizzing by my face. And so I got myself back behind cover and I put my last mag in. And one of the guys was getting too close to me. And again, I didn't know Jay was the dynamics of that shootout would have changed if I would have known that Jay was hurt like he was. I know I'd have killed four of them because there was a time that I could have shot four of them and killed them.
Mm-hmm.
When the last guy that got real close to me, I shot him through the fat of his, right through his calf. I was just trying to shoot him in the kneecap to get him from advancing on me because I knew I was down to like four or five rounds. So I was running out of protection and I put him down and then fired a couple more rounds. I started hearing the sirens. Finally, my gun's empty. I holster it, grab a knife that I had, and I just waited for these dudes to come and kill me, you know. The police showed up, and they engaged those guys that were still shooting. They went right by me. So I took off running. I slid over and I grabbed Jay, pulled him up on me, and I'm slapping him in the face. I flip my phone open, and I dial Dragon Man. He's like the first guy on my contacts, and I'm trying to wake Jay up, and I finally pull his hat and his scarf off, and that's when I saw that he had a bullet entry wound to his forehead. Dragon Man answered the phone. I told him, look, Jay's been shot, and I said, I'm going to jail. So I said, you need to get some people down here to protect my family. And I got arrested. They're handcuffing me, and I hear this car, thought it was going to run over us, squealing tires, brakes lock up, guy jumps out of the driver's seat, and it's my dad. He's just like, where's your brother? Where's Jay? He's like, is he all right? And I couldn't even speak. I just shook my head no. I don't think my dad's ever looked at me the same way since that day. I mean, I know we are still best friends and I know that he loves me, but you know, not anything you ever want to tell somebody. So I got arrested. Still the only person that's ever been arrested at that ordeal.
None of the Black Berets were ever arrested?
No, sir. And, you know, looking back at it, I think I understand why the dynamics of that case went the way they did. So I went to jail. It's all these cops, hey, you just need to cooperate. You need to tell us what's going on. You know, and I bail out the next morning. One of the detectives, and I understand why he did it. He came in and he sat down. He's like, look, Malachi, Jay's in surgery. He's going to survive. The bullet mushroomed on his scalp and went around. He's in surgery. So you just need to cooperate. We need to put a stop to what's going to happen after this. And you need to help us do that. And I didn't. I told him I don't have anything to say. And then I got out. I bailed out the next morning at 8 o'clock. Walked out to the Sallyport thing. And my dad, I saw there was a big Suburban there, a bunch of people in it. And I ran up to the truck and I opened the door and I looked and I said, why are all of you in this car? Why aren't you at the hospital with my brother? Why are you here to pick me up? I said, is Jay okay? And my dad was like, he's gone.
Mm.
And the hardest thing, you know, in the world I've ever had to deal with, I know I screamed, I'll never forgive myself or something along those lines. And I went home and tried to console my parents, made a few phone calls. And then my lawyer showed up and he said, you got a court date at 11 o'clock. And I was like, I just got out of jail, bro. And he's like, we got to go. So I walked in the courtroom and I already knew I was going back to jail. There was 100 police officers in the courtroom, nobody else but me and the judge and my lawyer and gang task force. And we're in a metropolitan courtroom with the circuit court judge. And they didn't lie. They told him, they said, hey, this dude's going to cause a bunch of problems. His brother's dead. And she raised my bond to $100,000 cash only. And I went back to jail for a few more months.
Mm.
Then I got a bond reduction hearing in front of a district court judge, and he instantly said, this isn't a capital murder case. This isn't right. So he reinstated my bond, let me back out. And then for the next 2 years, I would be on house arrest, ankle monitor. Had to go pee in a cup every single day of those 2 years.
Wow.
Never had a drug charge in my life. And yeah, without fail, Christmas Day, didn't matter. Still had to go. What I can think of, what Jeff and I at least put together is that the state of New Mexico was already aware of the Bandidos, and the catalyst for the violence was us moving into town. And so they were comfortable, I think, with dealing with those guys, but they definitely wanted to not have me there anymore. And so I wasn't allowed to go. I tried to work it out of my house, and our business just crumbled, man. That the guy wouldn't renew our lease. There was just a lot of things, you know?
Mm-hmm.
And then like a week before trial, I was on my way out the door to get a suit. My lawyer called me and he's like, hey, have you talked to anybody? And I said, no, Ray, why would I talk to anybody? He's like, they dropped the charges against you. And I couldn't believe it. It was a victorious day for sure, you know? And then I got contacted national as soon as that case was over and was like, I don't want to be here anymore.
Why did they dismiss the charges?
So from what I understand, those guys were never going to testify anyway. You know, those guys are in a Bandido support club. So they were never going to stand up and testify. That would be the end of them, you know? So I believe that the trial went on to try to do exactly what it did, which is damage the business, damage my livelihood, and make me move on. They were able to, this is the other thing, they tried to mess up my schooling, because right in finals, I'm driving home one day, and all of a sudden I look and there's the Calvary's behind me, and they drug me and my 16-year-old son out of the car, face down, handcuffed us, took me back to jail, rearrested me for intimidating a witness. I had seen the guy that shot my brother and killed him, even though I didn't know it was him. And he threatened me through my window when I had my one-year-old son in the back. And I drove home immediately, called my lawyer and told him what happened. And this guy went to the detectives instead of calling 911 if I had threatened him, like what a normal person would do. This guy went to the detective. They wrote out a warrant and arrested me during my finals week. And my attorney ripped them a new one for the way that they handled it. The judge dismissed the charges. But then the detective stood up and told me that they had forensically matched the bullet that killed my brother to the gun and the guy, and that he wasn't being charged, that it was self-defense. And so I believe that all happened because they wanted me in custody when that news was explained to me. Regardless, I reach out to National and I tell them, look, what's going on? What's my next move? And they said, we're opening up Arkansas and Oklahoma. If you want to, you can go run Arkansas. And so this was like in my class that I teach, this is where it's like you start to realize that no love, no loyalty. Because up to this point, I characterized the first half of my time with the Vagos as being ignorant, which means I was giving 100%. I was in it for the long haul, and these guys weren't loyal to me. But I would characterize the second half of my career with them as stupidity. Because one-sided loyalty is called stupidity. When you're loyal to people and they're not loyal back and you continue to do it, you're stupid. But again, they didn't do jack for my family, nothing. You know, they didn't help with any of the bills. They didn't help me with my attorney. And I can understand if I'd have been like Jabbers, drunk and kicked off some bullshit, but I was sober, stone sober, because I tell you what, if I hadn't have been, I'd be dead. I'd have put a gun in my mouth with the horrible things that I've dealt with and that responsibility, making a decision that cost somebody that you love your life. He wasn't just Japheth. He wasn't just Japheth Seaman. He was my best friend, my younger brother, my responsibility. And these dudes hadn't done nothing. I'm like, where are all the cuts? Like, there's plenty of banditos running around the city. Why haven't you guys done your due diligence? You owe me, you know? So with that mentality, I moved my family to Arkansas, which would be very short-lived. I got some dope fronted to me from California so I could make some money. Kicked off a little pipeline out there and started using. You know, I was coming back from California and got high with one of my brothers, and it was the worst thing I could have done at that point because it didn't hurt anymore. As soon as I got high, I didn't care if Selena was mad I wasn't home. I didn't care if my kids were upset, and I didn't feel responsible for Jay's murder. I didn't feel like anything. And so that catalyst, you know, and there's a bunch of banditos out in Arkansas. So I just start kicking doors in. I just start going to bars, getting me trophies, dude, thinking that's going to make me feel better. That stomping out banditos and taking their cuts is going to, and it doesn't make me feel better. And then pretty soon, instead of my whole charter being with me, it's dwindling. So I don't really want to go into too many details out there, but that was what was going on out there. And then pretty soon it didn't matter. I'd be by myself. And it was like, if you just looked like you were wearing red or gold, you know? And I wasn't getting along because what they did is they opened Catoosa, Oklahoma, and Gentry, Arkansas. So those are 45 minutes from each other. And I did not get along with another. He's just a coward, a bully, guy named Vegas Valley Dog. He was the P of that charter. And, you know, he just liked to get drunk and beat up on little people. So I'm just in this full-on rage mode. I'm trying to feel this. I'm trying to take all this stuff and stuff it down into this big hole I have in my chest, man. And I come home one day after three or four day bender. I remember my one hand was covered in blood, and I can't even figure out how long I'd been walking around like that. And the house is empty. My kids are gone. The wife's gone. The car's gone. The only thing that's in there is my shit. And I called her and she's like, look, I'm in Arizona. And, you know, if you're not going to change, we're done. If you're not going to change, then don't even call me anymore. So it was close to my daughter's birthday, and this would be the first time I get center punched. I just pack up I don't say anything to anybody, and I go to Arizona.
How many children did you have?
So I have 3 sons. We adopted a third son recently.
I mean, at that time, how many children did you have?
Three. Yeah.
Okay.
2 boys and a girl. I get down to Arizona. I get a call from little D, a guy in my charter. And I said, it is what it is. And so I'm trying to get things working there. Little D comes down, National comes down. We have a meeting and they're like, look, Arkansas is a bad fit for you. We want to kick Arizona off. There's nobody out here. But they're like, this is your last stop. You know, we tried to open a charter here 3 times before. There's this detective out here named Jeff Files. And so we don't care how you do it, but it doesn't fail. And I said, I understand. So I took my wherewithal and everything that I had. I became the president of that charter and started a PR mission trying to get us back in the bars. And so I'm just, you know, going and talk to the bars, trying to set up poker runs, trying to do things. I've got a little pipeline that's starting to prosper a little bit. You know, you got California, Arizona, Nevada right there.
And you're back in Albuquerque. Is that right?
No, I'm in Arizona now, Bullhead City.
Sorry. Okay. Gotcha.
So that's what I start doing. I start recruiting guys under the table. They gave me like 3 boxes of all these police reports, search warrants and everything from the task force, you know? And I'm like, this dude's good, man. Cause he nailed everybody and he would nail a couple guys and get them to turn on each other and then exploit everything. And like I said, he took down 3 charters, man. And then one of the things I realized though is he was using women. I was like, he's got to be using women to make these drug transactions. Cause you know, as a Vago, if I'm in a bar and some dude comes up and starts asking questions, he's going to get, you know, going to get thumped and sent out his way. But you take a pretty girl and send her into that same situation and she's going to get, you know, drinks bought and sit down and whatever. You know? So by the time Jeff and I had our first face to face, I already had almost 20 guys in a charter. And it was interesting thing is I didn't recognize him at first, but I did not like him and feeling was mutual. And we were standing about a foot away from each other, just looking at each other, just trading facts and insults back and forth, you know?
Mm-hmm.
But what I would come to realize later during my law enforcement career, me and Yazzie were chasing a guy. We chased him into Bullhead City and he hit somebody and caused a fatality accident. Mm. Jeff and I were working that accident together.
Really?
Yeah, so we were actually at 2 different places at one time. We went for Shop with a Cop for Christmas 1 year, and I saw him. And the next time I saw him was at that accident investigation.
Wow. Small world, huh?
Yeah. So we started having some really successful bike nights, and I was still self-medicating and trying to keep it under control so Selena didn't leave. And we opened 2 motorcycle shops, different locations, and started pumping the workout again. Had my cousin, Jed, we found this support club that we wanted to pull into ours from Phoenix, and we pulled him in and then put my cousin and a few other guys. It was called the Zopilotes. And things are like from that gang standpoint, you know, things are really good. We had a real big, huge bike night. A bunch of Vagos came down from California, and it was, as these things are all going, recovering from the incident with my brother and everything, my status, you know, went to superstar status, you know, in that organization.
Mm-hmm.
Because I had, you know, I was just a proven soldier, man. When people got after us, we got back.
Mm-hmm.
And then Jeff turned the heat up. Jeff just was not getting the results that he wanted. And so the next time we have a bike night, it was so bad, man. They pulled over one of our guys and he was smoking a cigarette and the cop's like, put your cigarette out. He flicks it. And he's like, turn around, put your hands behind your back. You're under arrest for littering. They're arresting guys for not wearing corrective lenses that were supposed to have it on their license. And it got so bad that now I'm getting shit from National. They're like, dude, what is going on? What have you stirred up down there? And I just, you know, relinquished back to my old ways. I started really self-medicating and I wasn't watching the charter and taking care of business like I was supposed to, spending a lot of time with females and not my wife. And then behind my back, these 2 guys that were in our charter. So this is what I did with Arizona. When I took over Arizona.
We've been going for over an hour again. Would you be willing to come back for a third part?
Absolutely.
So, ladies and gentlemen, obviously I just surprised him with this, but I wanted to leave this on a cliffhanger with you because I want you to come back and listen. I've got so many more questions for Malachi here, and that we didn't plan on doing a third episode, but we're just learning so much here. I think it's worth it, and he's willing to do it. So thank you for joining us again for part two. Now you know there's going to be a part three, and you got to come back and find out what happens after Jeff and his guys are rousing these guys up, and poor Malachi here is back in the tweaker pipe, which you don't know this, Malachi, but our number one rule here on Game of Crimes is kids don't do meth, because we know how bad it is, and you do too.
That's right.
So everybody, please come back again tomorrow. You'll hear the rest of the story, just like Paul Harvey used to say, but appreciate you coming to join us. We look forward to seeing you tomorrow. Until then, God bless.